Amen. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, worship team. Let's all have a seat, and I'd like to invite you to reach for your Bible and turn to Matthew chapter 22, verse 41. If you don't have a Bible on you, there's one under the seat in front of you or under your own seat. Hope you bring in your own Bible, and I certainly commend you for coming out this first Wednesday of the new year. I think it's a good habit to get into. Of course, I get paid to do this, but you all come of your own free will, and so I appreciate your presence. I'm going to move this because I don't like to hear myself while I'm doing this. There you go. You turn off the monitor. Thank you. It's funny up here. It sounds like I got an echo. It's bad enough just to be up here. It's scary enough. Look at all these faces, these threatening faces. No, not at all, not at all. You're my friends. I know that, and you love me, and I appreciate that. Matthew chapter 22, we are looking at the final episode in what we spent 10 weeks on. And I'm going to have to remind you, because 10 weeks ago we began with the triumphal entry, and we've now come to the conclusion of a series of episodes that plays out after that triumphal entry and leaves Jesus' adversaries speechless when Jesus asks them a question, which I'm going to call the Christ conundrum. He does this in order to not stump them, but to try to get them to think about what really is the biggest issue, and that is, who is he? What do they expect from Messiah? So we have this final question that's going to leave his interlocutors speechless, but before we get there, I'd like to show you what we've covered in the last 10 weeks so you can see how chapter 21 and 22 are so full of episodes, but they all go together and they're meant to culminate in this conundrum. You all know what a conundrum is. I use this for alliteration purposes, but a conundrum is just a very difficult problem or question. It's not like a mystery in the sense that a conundrum actually has a solution. You just got to put your mind to work to come up with the solution. A mystery is something that you can endlessly think about and reflect upon. A paradox is two extremes that you're trying to draw together. This isn't either of those. This is actually just a conundrum. It's a difficult proposition that Jesus is going to place before his hearers, but it has an answer if you're willing to put some work into it. And it all goes back to that triumphal entry at chapter 1 where we began, where Jesus finally publicly comes out. He demonstrates that he perceives himself as Israel's Messiah. The people gather around him, at least some of them do, and say, "Hosanna to the Son of David." And there's this wonderful reception as he comes into Jerusalem. But the excitement dies down pretty quickly when his first act in entering Jerusalem is to go to the temple and to cleanse the temple, to do something which many of his people around him see as something very unpatriotic, something very radical and rebellious. And then he follows that up by bringing women, children, and the sick into the temple, and he begins to heal them. So he kind of takes over. It becomes his space, and he begins to do the acts of Messiah in the midst of the temple. Well, as you'd expect, the religious leaders are none too happy about this, and so they corner him, and they say, "Whose authority are you doing this by? What right do you have to actually do what you're doing in here?" And Jesus says, if you remember, "I'll answer that question if you answer this question: John's baptism, from heaven or from men?" And they can't answer that question, or they refuse to answer that question. And Jesus says, "I won't answer your question either." And then he goes on a small tirade. In each one of these things we spent a week on, so this is 10 weeks worth of review, he has three scathing judgment parables where he's speaking to his listeners and talking about the obedient son and the disobedient son, and then the wicked tenants, and then the wedding banquet. All of these make the religious leaders look bad. So they group together, they gather around, they huddle, and they come up with some trick questions for him. First, the Herodians ask him the trick questions about taxes to Caesar and whether they should be paid or not. And Jesus gives them that wonderful answer that we looked at there. Give to Caesar what is Caesar, give to God what is God's. Then the Sadducees come up and question him about resurrection, which they don't believe in. They're trying to trip him up, and they give him this absurd illustration of resurrection, and Jesus answers their question. And then finally, a Pharisee comes up and says, well, what's the greatest commandment? And of course, they're trying to trip him up once more, because whatever he picks as the best commandment, they're going to say, well, why didn't you think of these other commands? And then he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. And they have nothing to respond to. That's what leads to our final episode here, because it appears like they're regrouping. They're trying to think of some more trick questions. And actually, the Message translation puts it like this. Verse 41, while the Pharisees were gathered together, and if you have a Message translation, while the Pharisees were regrouping. So they're regrouping. They're trying to think of some more stumper questions, because they're bound and determined to get this unschooled person to fall prey to some of their deep theological tricks. And so they're regrouping. They're ready to ask him a question, but they don't get a chance, because while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus now asks them this question. So he puts them on the spot and becomes the questioner. And the question is quite simply, verse 42, what do you think about the Messiah or the Christ? Whose son is he? And the thing I love about that question is, after Jesus has been barraged by all these trick questions, he wants to get at the heart of what this is all about. And it's about Messiah. Who is Messiah? What will Messiah be like? What do we expect of Messiah? Whose son is he? And so we have this very, very pointed question that shows us they want to play around with questions about taxes and resurrection and commandments. Jesus wants to get to what really matters. Who is he? Who do they perceive him to be? We've already seen this in Matthew 16, the very center of Matthew's gospel. The question Jesus asks his small group of disciples, who do people say that I am? Who do you say that I am? This becomes the preeminent question. And Peter, of course, says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. You've been given the divine answer. You've been given a revelation from God. So we've already seen this play out with this small group of disciples. Now Jesus is coming to these adversaries and saying, you know, this is what matters most. You want to trip me up with taxes, trip me up with resurrection challenges, trick me up with commandments, and which one's more important or less important, or are they all equally important? But I'm saying to you that what matters most, who is Messiah? What will Messiah be like? And so he gives them a very, very interesting question, the most important question, what do you think about the Christ? And to set them up, he says, whose son is he? And ask a question that they have to answer. Now, we've seen before the Pharisees have dodged this question by refusing to answer questions. The baptism of John, from heaven or from men? We don't know. That's one of their favorite answers, because they don't have to commit to anything. But you have to commit to this. Whose son is he? Well, everyone knows the son of David, they replied. That's a given. Everybody is quite aware that the answer you have to give to that question is that Messiah is King David's son. That's the right answer. But Jesus isn't finished. He set them up, verse 43. He said to them, how is it then that David, speaking by the Spirit, calls his son Lord? For he says, and he is David, and now he quotes from Psalm 110, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. If then David calls his son Lord, how then can he be his son? Now, I want to take that apart a bit, because he's really put them in a difficult position where they have to wrestle with who Jesus is, or at least who Messiah is, and Jesus is hoping they'll move to him in that. But he's quoting from Psalm 110 in verse 44. Your version should have that placed out like a poem, because he's quoting from the Psalms. Psalm 110 is an important messianic psalm. One point of note, the most quoted psalm in the entire New Testament, the New Testament, which quotes different parts of the Old Testament again and again. The psalm that the New Testament quotes more than any other psalm is Psalm 110. For other reasons than this, but this is one of the main reasons, because it's speaking of Messiah. And so Psalm 110 was understood by ancient Jews to have been written by David. Modern theologians will say, we don't know if it was actually David or other people, and you could play around with that game if you want, but at least for Jesus' hearers, they understand David to have penned these psalms. And so when they hear these psalms sung or prayed, they understand that these songs first came from the lips of David, which is why at the end of verse 43, he can say, for David says this, and here's what David said, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my hand till I put your enemies under your feet. Well, the Lord, the first Lord is Yahweh. In the psalm, it's clearly Yahweh. So that's God. God said to my Lord. So David is saying, my God, the Lord, has said to my master or my Lord as well, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. The question Jesus is asking them is, how can David, under the inspiration of the Spirit, call his son Lord? Now, that might not mean as much to us. We've been raised in a democracy, all people are equal. But in the ancient world, there were royal families. In the ancient patriarchal world, the head of the family was always the superior. That's why to this day, we still think of Abraham as the patriarch of the people of Israel, because he's first. That's how patriarchies work. The head begins, and then we think of David, or at least the Jews did, as the first and greatest king. He's the first. He's the head. And so all of those in his family rule under the stability and integrity and identity of being associated with David. They are lesser than David. They are inferior than David because David is the greatest. They are in the lineage of David. Are you following there? So in a patriarchy, the head matters, the first matters, and it's silly to say for David that my son is my superior. He'd have to think of his son as his successor at best, but never his superior. And yet you have David saying in this psalm, God, Yahweh, has said to my superior, my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put all of your enemies under my feet. David is granting greater authority to his descendant than even to himself. So the conundrum is this. How can the Messiah be both David's Lord and David's son? Now, in the modern world, you can still get traces of how silly it would be for me to say, for example, Owen, who is my son, my 15-year-old son, or Adam, my 13-year-old son, Adam is my Lord. The Lord said to Adam, my Lord. Now that's just one generation removed. But this is David saying to those in a future lineage, this is my master. But how can this Messiah be both David's Lord and David's son? How can he be both David's ancestor and yet his descendant? How can he both succeed him and yet somehow precede him in superiority? And what you have is a time sequence conundrum. It is a challenge of how is it that David can speak of his son with the same kind of respect and honor that you give to your superior, especially when he's his son. And at best, he is his successor or inferior. And you have what's called a time conundrum problem. Gregory Anderson Love gets at the heart of this when he says the time sequence conundrum of David's relationship to his descendants and to the one he calls my Lord is solved only if his Lord is the Messiah. And this Messiah somehow transcends time and is owed loyalty by David. Now we have wonderful phrases for summarizing this. Son of David, son of God. Peter's already said of Jesus, who do you say I am? You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. So that when the Pharisees say son of David, they're correct insofar as that goes, but Jesus is more than the son of David. Jesus is not only David's descendant, Jesus is David's Lord and God, if Jesus is Messiah. Now, Jesus has already made claim to that in the triumphal entry, and he's trying to get them to see that David has spoken of him and has spoken of him in a way that makes him greater than David, which is unheard of in the patriarchal world of regal authority. It's just unheard of that all of a sudden now this successor is the greater. And all of a sudden you begin to get close to what's going on here and what Jesus is trying to get them to see. They began this whole discussion with the question of authority. What right do you have to do this? Well, they will never see Jesus as having the authority to do what he does until they're able to see that he has the authority of David, but even more, he has the authority of God. That he, in some way, precedes and succeeds David. He is David's descendant, but in some strange way, he's David's ancestor. Some way, David speaks of him in a sense that he precedes even David. One other quote may help here. Larry Schoenard says this: the question is not intended to undermine his Davidic roots or Messiah's Davidic roots, but to emphasize the transcendent status of the Messiah. The true nature of the Messiah cannot be understood as merely a kingly figure. The Messiah has to be understood as David's pre-existent Lord. Now this takes us into some strange places. This takes us into places that some people are unwilling to go, because then you have to start assigning a transcendent quality to Jesus. He's not just a descendant of David, the son of David, but you have to speak of him in the same breath as also the Son of God. Now, Jesus has brought this question to the forefront because that really is the question at the heart of understanding who he is. That Jesus' greatness doesn't have to do with the fact that he's giving some brand new teaching on taxes or some brand new commandment, because he doesn't give any new commandment. Love God with all your heart, soul, strength. Love your neighbors yourself. It doesn't have to do with him giving some new teaching on resurrection. The Jews already believed in resurrection. It has to do with him challenging the people that the kingship he's bringing is greater than David's. It has to do with him having a greater status than David, which is as it should be. We do know this: David was a man after God's own heart, but his hands were full of violence and blood. And yet that's the kind of king that most people wanted in that day. They wanted a man who had a heart for God's law, but was ready to smite the Gentiles. And so David fit well in that mentality. But even in our Old Testament, we read when David wants to build the temple, God says, "You can't build the temple. You are a man of blood. It's not for you to do. You are God's king, but you're not God's kind of king when it comes to the ultimate giving of the kingdom of God." Jesus is coming with a whole different dimension to him, not smiting his enemies, but loving his enemies. Not coming to enact violence and overpower the enemy, but to give himself up and to make himself sacrifice to the enemy. All of this has been foreshadowed in the Old Testament. It's not just Psalm 110. There are other passages. We sang a song, The Ancient of Days. I'm glad we picked that song, because in Daniel 12, I saw this vision, Daniel writes, one like a son of man came to the throne and gained the throne of the Ancient of Days. And you get this image of some transcendent figure that is given this kingdom. But you're also given this wonderful metaphors that the New Testament will make use of, but I think Jesus may be alluding to here. Isaiah 11 is a good example. A shoot will come up from the stump of David. So you have a stump, the tree's been felled, and a shoot comes up. And yet, from his roots, a branch will bear fruit. So we have a shoot, we have the roots. And in that day, not the shoot of Jesse, but the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him and his resting place will be glorious. Now, roots much more foundational than a shoot. And yet, this one is called both the root and the shoot. Now, the way the book of Revelation will put it is the best. Because at the end, you'll have this wonderful vision. And then one of the elders said to me, "Don't weep. See the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David." Not the seed of David. But the very foundation, the root, the one that precedes even David, has triumphed. And then in the final verses of Revelation of our canon, of our New Testament, I, Jesus, have sent my angel to give you this testimony for the churches. And so in this unveiling, Jesus actually speaks and says, I've given this book. It is a testimony to the churches. And then his stamp of identity is, I am the root and the offspring of David. That's the solution to the Christ conundrum. I am both David's descendant and I am also David's Lord. I descend from him, but I also precede him. The book of John will put it, in the beginning was the Logos, the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, the Son of David. And yet this Logos, we develop that into the second person of the Trinity, that God, God's self, comes to us and reveals the very heart of God in and through the person of Christ. Isn't that a wonderful phrase, though? That's the answer to this Christ conundrum. For them to be able to say, you, Jesus, are not only the offspring of David, ruling in the way of David, which includes having a heart for God, but also being a man of violence, but you're the root. You're what God's always intended in a king. You're what God has always desired, because you are bringing God's reign to us fully and truly. You are our Emmanuel, as the book of Revelation, book of Matthew began with, that Jesus is Emmanuel, God with us. So all these threads are beginning to come together, and the Christ conundrum is developing in such a way that we can see the answer to it, but you can't receive the answer until you're willing to say that there's something very special and unique about Jesus. He's not just human. He's fully divine. He's not just the Son of David. He's the Son of God. He's not just the one who is born among us. He is the Alpha and Omega, who rules from eternity. And unless you're willing to go that far, Jesus remains a conundrum. Jesus remains, if you will, a bit out of reach. And of course, for the Pharisees, Jesus remains simply a threat, because they're never going to understand who he is and his basis for authority until they come to accept and understand his transcendent status as David's Lord. Here's the issue. These Pharisees, if David were to be among them at that moment, would submit in a heartbeat to David. They'd submit to his authority in a second if he were to come among them. Why won't they submit to David's Lord? That's what's going on here. They'd submit to David because David's the kind of king that has enough God, but also enough of the ways of the world to satisfy them. But they won't submit to David's Lord, whom David delights in and says he is the one that rightfully should inherit all the ends of the earth. He is the one who should be the one whose enemies are finally and forever put under his feet. So since they can't accept that, they have but one thing to do. And of course, we know what that is. We know the end of the gospel. They'll have to crucify him. They can't outsmart him. They can't outdebate him. They certainly can't silence him at this point. So the only thing left to do is to overpower and crush. And that's why in verse 46 it ends as it does. No one could say a word in reply. And from that day on, no one dared to ask him any more questions. He's bested them just one too many times. He's bested them at their best game. They're all waiting for Messiah, and yet the Messiah they want is not the Messiah they need. The Messiah they expect is not David's Lord. It's perhaps another version of David, but it's not the Lord that David delighted in. It's not the root and offspring of David. It's just an offspring. And so with the adversary silenced and their tricks upended, what's interesting as this ends and we move into the next chapter for next week, these are expert teachers in the law. They know their Bible inside and out, and they have just been confounded by an unschooled kid, carpenter from Nazareth, who hasn't been to any of their rabbinical schools, that hasn't been through any of their educational process, who hasn't been involved in any rabbinical dialogue, and yet he has completely outmastered them and confounded the greatest theologians of the land. And so they only have one recourse. They actually have two, but one they won't choose. The other recourse is to say, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God," as Peter did. But instead, they will begin to regroup once again, but this time it's not to ask questions. It's to silence once and for all this threat to them. They can't outsmart him, so they'll destroy him. That will lead us into next week, and we'll have plenty of time for discussion here. Do you see chapter 23? One of the most amazing chapters in all of Matthew. And before they have the opportunity to unleash their vitriol on Jesus, Jesus is going to pronounce a series of prophetic woes against religious leaders. It is harsh. What's interesting to me is I've seen almost every Jesus movie there is. You rarely get chapter 23 in any of these movies, even though it should be there. Because Jesus, before they're going to actually take him and crucify him, is going to, like one of the best prophets in the Old Testament, "Woe to you, woe 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 to you. You do this, 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 and this." And then he's going to weep like the prophets over Jerusalem. Then he's going to be taken. So that's how this is going to come to its conclusion. But what will be interesting for us next week is we look at these woes. We're not going to look at them as if we're just going to say bad Pharisees, because there's only one reason Matthew preserved these. This is for Christian leaders in the Christian church to learn how not to lead. He's not keeping this as an archive so we can just say, "Hey, they were really bad, weren't they?" He's keeping it so that the same mistakes aren't made by leaders within the church that Jesus has founded. So we're going to look at all this in more detail next week. I didn't want to try to crunch all of that into this. This needs to stand on its own. But you know what it really does? It shows us that in the Gospel of Matthew, there's a lot of debate and dialogue and controversies around all kinds of things. But the thing Jesus keeps wanting to bring people back to, his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" The Pharisees, "What do you say about the Christ?" That matters, because it's only when they can embrace who he is that they can actually hear what he says. And so that becomes the central issue. They need to not only hear what he says, but know that his authority is the authority of God's, and his revelation is the revelation of God's. And it's a new and greater way than even the great way of David, than even the great way of Moses. You've heard it said, but I say unto you, than even the great way of the temple, that it is a way that they need to hear that the greater one has come, the superior one has come, the transcendent and preeminent one has come, Jesus the Christ. All right, give you a little bit of time to process that. Any questions, comments, thoughts? Sure, certainly would be a lot, I would think, or at least hope there is. If not, we can move into our prayer, and I want to say a word or two about a parishioner before we do prayers. Go ahead, Frank. You have the sacred amplifier.
In the Jewish history, particularly when Jesus was living, did every boy have to attend school under a rabbi?
No.
No?
I don't think so. I think the privileged ones would get to, but more impoverished ones would just be doing the farm work, just like we'd see in our culture 100 years ago.
Being more impoverished, he didn't go to...
Jesus being impoverished, and we know he's impoverished. His mother and dad make a stepdad make an offering of dove when the most impoverished offering you could make. It's likely that he probably didn't get that kind of training, but it's also very likely, with his mother and father being as devout and righteous as they were, that he was in attendance at synagogue and at all the Jewish festivals regularly.
And he was really homeschooled.
Probably, but that's kind of common prior to some other things. And it's almost always been, up until, thank God recently, that the most privileged get the education, and those without that kind of privilege or wealth milk the cows.
Did the girls get an education?
Rarely, yeah. Yeah, and really, that's even being nice. Probably be better to say no. Good question. Mr. Bill?
I was just curious because I think it's odd about it before, but it refers to Jesse and it refers to David.
Jesse is David's father.
Okay. I should have known that if you go through the
Yeah, that's all right. And again, you know, you got to get in a patriarchal mode, and in a patriarchal mode, the preceder is always greater than the successor. So we're really talking about David, but we'll refer to him as Jesse's son. Yeah.
Along those lines, I know, especially around the time that Jesus was doing his ministry and kind of that, there were a ton of false prophets, a ton of people saying, you know, I'm the one that. That's
right.
I think kind of where the Pharisees were coming from, seeing, well, maybe this guy is one of these phonies. Was there any other that we are aware of? Was there anybody else in the line of Jesse and David that was alive at that time, or was Jesus it?
Jesus wasn't it. There, it's interesting if you read Josephus and others. There are scores and scores of messianic claimants, people that lay claim to it. Many of them choosing a very violent or way of the zealot in trying to mimic what had happened a couple hundred years earlier with Judas Maccabees, who through guerrilla warfare began the freeing of Israel once again for at least a short while. So there was numerous claimants. Jesus would have experienced one that failed miserably and seen the crosses as a little child. And there, of course, were those around his time. There were those after him as well. That tends to end around AD 70 once the temple's destroyed. At that point, you know, the game's over. Rome destroys the temple altogether, and that is the end of there being any chance or hope for a Jewish resurrection of its tradition and its deepest symbols. But yeah, there are plenty of claimants, and that would be one reason that many would be very averse to jumping at any person. What Jesus had going for him was his intellect, the teaching he brought, and his healing and his nonviolent way. Some of those being a deterrent to people actually receiving him in the first place. You know, the teaching was just love your enemies. Okay, that can't be right. And other things. So there are plenty of people making claims. And you know, it's interesting. If you follow history and you keep in the news, there are people right now that are alive right now that claim to be Messiah. And 20, 30 years ago, you remember when Mooney claimed it and others? I mean, people are claiming it all the time. When you hear someone claiming to be the Messiah, you should just run, not walk to the nearest exit. And get all your loved ones as far away from them as you can. I think it's easier for me to say because I believe Jesus is the Messiah. So I have a Messiah. No thanks. I don't need another. But if you don't have one, I could see how you'd be susceptible. It's always, you know, there's more of a susceptibility to that. I also think the longer you hang around anybody, and Jesus' disciples are perfect examples of this. As we read through the Gospels, Jesus' disciples bumble, stumble, they don't understand, they foul things up. The more you hang around anybody, you realize that anyone that claims to be Messiah has high standards to live up to, and even the disciples can't live up to that. And so they don't make any claim to it. It's interesting, all of our epistles, none of them kind of take up the mantle and say, well, Jesus isn't around, so I'm the new Messiah. Instead, they all stick to their guns and go to deaths as martyrs, saying, the Messiah is alive, Jesus is risen, he is Lord, he is the one that they want to point everybody to, that Jesus is Messiah. Any other questions, comments, thoughts? Right up here, Laura. And we'll make this our last one. Thank you for your good attention.
Successful But I've seen, you know, the love of God and Christ in so many different people that offering, you know, actually sometimes even the fewest of the intellectual people that I've known that have that humility about you, that I don't know, it's interesting because sometimes I do not know that smart, but I overthink things, and that's when I can shut myself off.
Well, and I overthink things too, and that's a kind comment. I've had so many professors and so many scholars that I've gone to listen to that you see that even better, lots better than me, that you see this deep humility. Because I think, here's a challenge I've seen in life. A little knowledge is dangerous. So that, you know, you read one book on Jesus and you think you've mastered Jesus and you know this much, there's your circle of knowledge, and you have that periphery, which is the circle of ignorance. So you know this much, and it seems like you only don't know this much. But the more you study, your circle gets bigger, and you may know more, but that circle of ignorance keeps expanding as well. And you become more and more aware of what you really don't know, and what really is debatable and up for grabs and is questionable. And so I really think for those who enter into kind of the intellectual side of understanding the faith, understand the first 50 books you read will probably make you think you're something, and then when you live 30 or 40 more years and read hundreds more, you'll realize how little you actually know in the vast expanse of all that could be known. But I also know this, and I believe this with all my heart. Faith is not about knowing. Faith is about loving. There are lots of people in the Bible that are great intellects that have little or no faith. There are lots of people in our Bible that have, you know, Peter, a fisherman. You know, he's obviously not the most schooled person in the world, but boy, he's got deep passion and deep love and deep faith. And we see that again and again. We should never mistake theological knowledge for deep religious conviction and or experience, ever. They can be compatible, but they're not necessarily, it doesn't mean cause and effect. You know a lot, and therefore you're that. So the Pharisees are the perfect example here. They know their Bible. They've forgotten more things about the Old Testament than you and I know. And yet they're going to kill Jesus. So, you know, it's really not about that. It's about learning of the God who's revealed God's self in a way that inspires us to love as God loves, to seek in faith, to trust in the Lord that has been given to us to save us, and to trust that that promise will be true no matter what comes our way. And having that kind of faith and trust has very little to do with intellect, and much more to do with love and a childlikeness of spirit and a willingness to entrust your soul and your life to the God who has given God's all for us. So that's a whole nother sermon, but that's a little summary of it.